Religious traditions tell stories. And one of the common stories in our insight meditation movement is a story of a man in the time of the Buddha whose name was Bahiya. And I'd like to tell you the story. And this story occurs in a collection of the Buddha's teachings called the Udana. And Udana, that word is sometimes translated into English as the inspired utterances. And one of the things that's common with these stories that appear in this collection is at the end, the Buddha utters in an inspired way, he utters a verse. And not everyone is aware the Buddha was, in a sense, a poet. He belonged to a oral tradition more than a literary tradition, my English. They had writing in the time of the Buddha, but it was not so commonly used. And so it was very much an oral tradition where people spoke in many creative ways and memorized things much more easier than we do now. And the Buddha spoke often in kind of inspired verse, just kind of extemporaneously made up a verse. So at the end of the story, we have this the Buddha offering his verse. And I'd like to start the story with the end, with the verse. Where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear, and darkness is not found. And when a sage, a Brahmin, through sagacity, has known this for himself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he is freed. When water, air, fire, and wind have no footing. Have no footing is an expression belongs to this ancient Buddhist tradition. And I don't think we really use it that commonly here in the West, in English. But we have things that are basically synonyms of it that we use quite commonly. Colloquially, we talk about having buttons that get pushed. And, that person pushed my buttons. Or, we have something that triggers us, another expression. It triggers us. We have a trigger. Some people have short fuses. We have fuses. So we have fuses and triggers and buttons and so we go about our life and certain things trigger us, push our buttons, we also talk about being in the grip of something. So you're in grip of a novel might be a pleasant thing, but in the grip of your anger might not be so pleasant at all. And so the mind grips onto things. So this kind of idea is referred to here as there's a foothold in the mind. Something can get a foothold, something can get in there and get established, have a place to stand. Sometimes I talk about how the experience of life, if they're going to cause us some degree of distress or suffering, they have to encounter something inside of us. There's like a wall that encounters, that offers resistance to our experience. And that wall is, it doesn't have to be there. And if the wall is not there, the experiences, in a sense, go right through. And so, for example, on retreats, it's not uncommon for someone to be unhappy about the sounds that a neighbor in the meditation hall is making during meditation. Someone's rustling too much, moving too much, coughing too much, undoing their Velcro Parker too much during the sitting. It's doing something that is somehow annoying to them, and they'll come to me and say, "You have to do something about that person." And inevitably, almost always, occasionally I've done something, but 99% of the time I don't do anything about that person. But rather I might suggest something like, what is it that sound that you hear is hitting inside of you? What's the resistance? What's blocking it? What's What's picking it up? Where's the foothold that sound is getting inside of us? And then it's pretty common. Most of the time, it's a happy ending. And the person will come back later in the retreat and say, "Oh, there's not a problem anymore." Usually, I have to ask, "What happened to that noisy person?" Because they usually forget. Oh, that. Oh, yeah, that's not a problem anymore. Because it doesn't hit anything, it just goes right through. There's sounds and just like, you know, just not an issue. Just like listening to the rustling of the leaves outside in the wind, it just kind of goes right through. So anyway, the way they're talking about here is it finds a foothold. Now, earth, water, wind, and fire is the most common way of talking about the experience of the world in the ancient Buddhist tradition. The experience of the world is said to be made of these four elements, the physical world. It's said to be the earth element and the water, the air element and the fire element and the wind element. Did I get it right? So here it's saying that the world gets no footing. So here's a mind that's not triggered, it's not in the grip of the world, it's not pushed around by the world. And in that place, he goes on to say, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, and the moon does not appear. So, you know, especially in the ancient world, they didn't have electricity. So if when those things weren't shining in the skies, then it was pretty dark. However, it goes on to say, in that place where things don't have a footing, darkness is not found. So is it a paradox? It's somehow a place where neither light nor dark apply. Somehow it's a place that has no color, perhaps, or no light doesn't relate to that place. So, for example, we might say in English, we might talk sometimes about having an experience of the timeless present. And it's somewhat rare, but sometimes it can feel very, very powerful that this moment seems timeless, or this period of time seems timeless. And we can just kind of rest there or hang out there or just kind of be there. And you can even look at your watch and just kind of seems to have no meaning at all, because you can kind of conjure up meaning if you kind of work at it, but it just seems it's so calm and so peaceful and so spacious that it feels very timeless, this moment. The timelessness of that moment has no color. It has no light. It has no darkness. But it's something that seems very significant for some people when they're in it, when they're tasting it. It's a place where time has no foothold. And probably in that timeless moment, other things have no foothold in us as well. That's why it's so timeless. Probably there's a degree of calm or peace where we're not going to be easily concerned by many things that trigger us or concern us or grip us in normal life. So, for example, some people are going backpacking or hiking in the mountains. Might be a time where it approaches something like a timeless moment or a very spacious time. And there's all kinds of things that are not going to trigger you up there that would trigger you down here. As I like to say, if you spill ketchup on your backpacking shirt, it's not going to have the same impact on you as if you spill ketchup on your business suit before the board meeting, you know, in your corporation. You know, where that really, you know, that's going to hit something inside of you, some concern. So there's something very precious about the state of mind or the dimension of consciousness where there is no grip, there is no attachments, no clinging, no resistance, that's quite free. And that place somehow, light and dark don't relate to it. And then a sage, a wise person, through wisdom, knows for him or herself, when a sage knows this for him or herself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, that person is freed. It's a description of freedom. So form and formless refers both to the world of form that we're in concepts, but also Buddhism points to a formless realm, of existence. It doesn't belong to concepts or form. But even you're freed from that as well. And then bliss and pain. Well, I like to be freed of pain, but this freedom from bliss, I mean, you know, this is where the Buddhism is kind of a party-pooping religion. Or we're afraid it's going to make us kind of dull or flat or plain. Somehow the ups and downs of life is what makes it rich. I think that in the timeless moment, if that works as a kind of example, it can feel so precious, so exalted, so special, that even winning the California lottery is not going to kind of get you going, because you've got something much better going on. Or there are experiences of love or compassion, which or peace, which are so compelling in the moment that there's a lot of things in normal life that belong to the ups and downs of life that actually, those ups and downs are kind of pale in significance compared to the richness of of these very rich states that we can experience. So to be free of both bliss and pain in Buddhism is pointing to something that's richer or more precious or more valuable. It's not a diminishing, but rather an enhancement of ourselves. So that's the inspired utterances. So now the story that gave rise to that poem. There was a man named Bahia of the bark cloth. Probably he was called of the bark cloth because he was kind of a religious ascetic kind of person. And probably he only wore clothes made of bark cloth, made of bark, kind of pounded bark. And he was living by the coast somewhere in India. And he was worshipped, revered, honored, venerated, given homage, a recipient of robes, alms food, lodgings, and medical requisites for the sick. So he's kind of a renunciant. He's not a Buddhist renunciant, but he's a renunciant in the Indian tradition of his time. And he's highly honored and revered among people who know him. I think the story works better if you also kind of hold him up at high esteem, that this is a person who's very mature, a person who has a lot of wisdom, a lot of maturity, and that maturity, you know, what does it mean to be spiritually mature or humanly mature? It can mean many different things, but I would suggest that one of the things it means is that a lot of the things that might trigger the mind to be reactive, the person is no longer going to be reactive to that. Somehow matured beyond that. Many of you, I'm sure, have matured in ways that you were not mature when you were 14. And most of you are not concerned about zits anymore. Or some of you, maybe, you know, the intricacies of dating is not something, you know, that grips you in the same kind of way maybe when you were 16, when it was so consequential, maybe. I don't know. But there's some kind of maturity that happens where certain things don't kind of impact on us in the same way as it does when we were younger. I like to think of Buddhism as a form of premature aging. Now, it's not something we want to advertise, but that's the secret. But but not physical aging, but rather the kind of maturity that comes where we have a kind of a perspective and understanding. We're not so easily triggered or pushed around by success and failure, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, you know, the variety of things that can push around the mind. And so this is a man who's probably fairly well developed. He's a wise person. And he's respected for his wisdom. He's respected for his maturity and for his degree of freedom. He's been renunciant for a long time. And so we're not talking about a spiritual initiative. Novice in all this. But we're talking about someone who's already quite mature. Then, when he was alone, this line of thinking arose for him. Now, of those who in this world are arhats, arhant is someone who's enlightened, freed, liberated. Of the people in this world who are arhats, or have entered the path of arhatship, the people are on a path leading to that possibility, am I one? So, he's pretty mature in his practice. He's revered a lot. And the combination of being mature and also revered is dangerous for your self-esteem. And so he's kind of wondering, am I an enlightened person? A reasonable question for someone practicing for a long time. Then a devata, kind of god, minor god, comes along and having compassion and desiring for Bahia's welfare, knowing what he was thinking, went up to where he was staying and said to him, "You, Bahia, are neither enlightened nor have you entered the path of enlightenment. You don't even have the practice whereby you would become enlightened or enter the path of enlightenment." Well. So that got his attention. And in return, he asks of the god, "But who, living in this world, with its, in this world, is enlightened or has entered the path to enlightenment?" The god said, "Bahia, there is a city in the northern country named Savati, where Varanasi is now in India, next to it. The Blessed One, an Arhat, rightly self-awakened, is living there now. He is truly enlightened and he teaches the Dharma that leads to enlightenment." So that's the good news. "Then Bahia, deeply chastened by the devata, left the seashore where he was right then, didn't waste any time, and in the space of one day and one night went all the way to where the Buddha was staying near Savati in Jetta's grove." So it's a long distance. I think it takes longer than 24 hours in India to walk that distance, but I think what it's meant to be said here, he didn't waste any time and he made it his priority, and that's what he did. He just kind of engaged all out to go find the Buddha. This became the most important thing for him. He'd heard there was someone enlightened and he was going to go find this person. Very motivated. And it speaks very well, I think, for his maturity, that he was willing to accept the fact that maybe he was not, had not completed his practice of liberation, and that maybe there was someone else who could teach him, and he would go and find that person. When he came there, where the Buddha dwelt, was living, a number of monks were doing walking meditation in the open air. He went to them, and on arrival said, "Where, venerable sirs, is the Buddha staying? I want to see him." And they said, "He has gone into the town for alms, goes out in the morning to collect his food for the day." Then Bahia, hurriedly leaving Jetta's grove and entering Savati, saw the Buddha going for alms, calming his senses at peace, his mind at peace, tranquil and poised in the ultimate sense, accomplished, trained, guarded, his senses restrained, a great one. Seeing him, he approached the Buddha, and on reaching him, threw himself down with his head at the Buddha's feet and said, "Teach me the Dharma, teach me the Dharma, O well-gone one, that will be for my long-term welfare and bliss." So he's asking to be taught. So he came all the way, 24-hour walking nonstop, long distance. As soon as he got there, he didn't stop to rest, didn't stop to eat. He just wanted to find the Buddha. He was intent. This is all about. So he goes into town, and he finds the Buddha, and he asks this question. When this was said, the Buddha said to him, "This is not the time, Bahia. I have entered the town for alms." Okay, he's not getting his breakfast, so... And this is not the appropriate time to receive a teaching, so you can kind of just wait, cool it. A second time, Bahiya said to the Buddha, "But it's hard to know for sure what dangers there may be for the Buddha's life, or what dangers there may be for mine." So in other words, you don't know if there's going to be a later time. Right? Who knows what's going to happen? So one of them might be hit by a car or something like that. You know, suddenly. And so the chance to ask the Buddha a question is going to, you know, hear an answer is going to disappear. So he understands how precious and how changeable, how fragile. I suggest that this man, Bahiya, knows something about the immense fragility and the fragile immensity of this life of ours. And because of a real sense of that, he was really, you know, he wanted now. He wanted the answer now. He wanted to know. So he asked a second time, and the second time the Buddha said to him, "This is not the time." A third time, Bahiya asked the same thing. Now, there's a tradition in Buddhism, maybe it's an ancient Indian tradition, when you ask someone three times, they have to reply. So the Buddha tried, but then after when the third time the question came back, then the Buddha responded. So this is a man, now remember, you know, how intent this man is. A man who is pretty mature, spiritually developed, his intent has arrived to the Buddha's, in the presence of the Buddha. And this moment now is really the important moment. This is the time. He's really here in the present moment. This is the time. Not in the future. Some people are, the foothold into their mind is the future. The thoughts about the future, that's what kind of grips them. Some people, it's the past that holds their mind in its grips. This is a man probably had freed himself of the past and the future enough to be there in a very clear and full and present way there in that time. And this is the time that was important for him. So there he was. And the Buddha now is going to teach him. So this is a very important moment in his life. Then, Bahiya, you should train yourself as follows. In reference to the seen, let there only be the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. So this is one of the reasons this is a very important passages in Vipassana world is it's talking about bringing a kind of presence to our experience where we're not caught up in the interpretations of the experience. So when you hear something, you let it just be a sound that you hear and not, I like it, I don't like it, that must be, you know, there must be a car or that must be, you know, Jack's car or, you know, kind of we go on and that reminds me of the car I had when I was a kid and, you know, but just the sound, the simplicity of it. Not what it does to my meditation. Oh no, that sound is bothering my meditation. How could it? How could IMC have started a meditation center on a street corner? And the mind goes off, right? Just sound, just let it be sound. It has no foothold on the mind, the sound, just sound. And one of the places of foothold is around self. What's in it for me? My meditation is being disturbed. So to just kind of be present for things in simplicity of how it actually is, prior to the interpretations, the conceptualization that goes on, is a big part of the training in Vipassana practice. Just be present for things in its simplicity, here and now. In the seen, just the seen, in the heard, just the heard, in the sensed, just the sensed, and the cognized, just the cognized. So the thought arises, recognition, the perception arises, and just let it be that way, a thought. You don't have to make anything about it, don't have to interpret it. Just let it float up and be there. But generally, with many people, with our thoughts, the thoughts don't just float up. But there's a foothold in the mind for that thought to land on. It takes a stand. And then we create universes out of our thoughts. we get in the grips of that concern. Becomes, you know. So here the instructions are basic Vipassana instructions of just let experience be as simple as it is and know it as it is. Then the Buddha went on. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahia, there is no you, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor there, nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. So one of the ways that we add interpretations to our experience, simplicity of a sound, is we create a self. We have this idea of a self. I am here. This is me. And it's possible to experience a sound without any reference to oneself, just sound passing through. And it's possible to experience it with, oh, it's, you know, all about me. It's possible not to have that self-consciousness about the experience. There's awareness. Awareness is luminous and clear and precise, aware of sounds and sights and everything. But it doesn't require us to have a self-concept, a self-identity, a self-representation, a self, a kind of idea of self that we're defending and building and explaining to others, presenting to others, representing to others. There's a way in which a kind of certain level of self-consciousness or self-reflection, neurotic self-reflection, can drop away. And the mind then, it's a mind that has no foothold for anything. So not only does water, air, wind, and fire not have a footing, but there's no footing upon which the footing, one of the primary footings, platforms, is this idea of self. And it's not saying there is no self. As someone said yesterday, you have to know which mouth to put the food into when you're eating. You don't become just kind of a blob. But there is this one, this possibility, this of a timeless present or the selfless present, where the mind is set free of that kind of turning back on itself in the grips of itself. So when we can let the experience be just simple, in the heard, just the heard, the seen, just the seen, and the cognized, just the cognized, without adding self, in that simplicity, you won't find a self over there in the sound. You won't find a self here as the kind of place where the sound is being registered. And you won't find a self in between the two. It'll just be sound and the registering of sound. And that is such an important moment or experience in Buddhism, that in that, the Buddha said, this, just this, is the end of suffering. So the place where there is no footing. Bahia was a very mature person. So the Buddha then gave us very succinct instruction that can be seen as very advanced instruction for meditation, or for very advanced practice. Other times, Buddha was teaching people who were not so developed as him. And he gave a much more elaborate instructions, teachings, and also elaborate kind of instructions of how to practice so a person can do the initial work of building up the maturity so they can be ready for this kind of deep kind of teaching. But Bahia was ready. Through hearing this brief explanation of the Dharma from the Buddha, the mind of Bahia, of the bark cloth, right then and there, was released from his attachments, from his, or actually the word is fermentations, or his toxins, by no longer clinging. So he let go of his clinging. And then he was released from all the toxic ways in which the mind can create suffering for itself. Having exhorted Bahiya of the bark cloth with this brief explanation of the Dharma, the Blessed One left, continued gathering his alms food. Not long after the Blessed One's departure, Bahiya was attacked and killed by a cow with a young calf, the equivalent of being run over by a car. And it's kind of a strange story, but I think maybe it's supposed to emphasize, the story emphasizes, you never know how much time you have, right? So this moment is really important, what you do. So this, just, you know, here the story kind of emphasizes this point. Then later the Buddha was told about this, and he said, Bahiya, the bark cloth, was wise. He practiced the Dharma in accordance with the Dharma and did not pester me with issues related to the Dharma. Bahiya, the bark cloth, monks, is totally liberated. In other words, he's kind of making clear that he's forgiving Bahiya for interrupting him on his alms rounds. And he's saying that he's got it right away. He didn't need any further explanation. And what strikes me also, he didn't need confirmation. He didn't need to go to the Buddha and say, did I get it? Is that the right experience? Am I now enlightened? Who, you know, I, right? Somehow his mind was set free, and there was no need then for confirmation. He knew. There was no self-preoccupation there that needed to be somebody for anybody. So he didn't pester the Buddha anymore. He was set free. Where water, then on realizing the significance of Bahiya's liberation, the Blessed One on that occasion exclaimed, where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear, darkness is not found. And when a sage, a Brahmin through sagacity, has known this for himself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he is freed. So this is a story where the Buddha is pointing to something which is closer to you than your own breath. It's right here. It's right here in this room. It's with us right now. It's as you think, as you feel, as you hear, as you see. Right here and now, there's something that's very, very simple. And in that simplicity, there's the possibility of not clinging to anything. Just this. May you have no footholds in your mind. Thank you.